Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Wonderful evening of broadcasting right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the Writer's Block, and I'm looking at Terry Shepherd grinning like a scalded kitty. I had to say, hey, this is Jim Christina, your host, and my co-host sitting out there in beautiful downtown Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hello, Bobby Jean.
Hey, Jim. Hey, did you, last time we were on, you were getting snow. Did you have a lot of snow last week and this week?
We did. Actually, there's still snow all over around here, but we're getting more, I think, on Friday or Saturday.
Oh, night. You have more coming. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Welcome, winter.
Yeah, welcome. Of course, and our author tonight, he's in Florida, so he doesn't even know what it looks like.
Snow probably has a different definition for him.
It does. It's called, yeah. So how's things going, Bobby? You got anything going on?
Just the normal, radio and out west shop, and I picked up a really fun part-time job. So I'm actually working out in Albuquerque and meeting people after being here almost 5 years and not really meeting very many people.
At the tea place, right?
Yes, at the St. James Tea Room. And right. What a fabulous, somebody, there are some cozy mystery series out there that use tea rooms as their place. This is special.
Oh, yeah, it does. Yeah. It's gorgeous. Well, yeah. I was going to listen to your show today on Equestrian Legacy.
Yes.
But I had to nap. I flipped the coin, heads came up, that man head down a pillow, nap time with the golden. That's where we were.
Well, you can always get it off the podcast, but that's our right guest today, Mickey Furman, is an unbelievable singer-songwriter. She's just released her first really Western album after years of performing a variety of music. Based in Nashville, and it was a really great show. Her music is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I'm gonna get into our guest tonight because he's sitting there. I can tell he wants to say something.
Yes.
Although I'm sure once we get him started, we're not gonna be able to stop him. So
that's okay.
Okay, and that's fine. Tonight's guest is a guest from, his publicist is Mickey Mickelson, a Creative Edge Publicity, where mine is, actually. He's a writer, he's a radio talk show host, he's an ex-DJ, we could just call him the Renaissance Man. I just think he does everything, including smile a lot. The guy's way too happy. I think it's the drugs. It can't be the 5 miles in the morning. Please welcome to the Writer's Block. His very first appearance, and hopefully not his last, Mr. Terry Shepherd. Hello, Terry.
Thanks, guys. Bobby Jean, I didn't realize that we both have Albuquerque in our past. I lived at Paseo and Eubank.
Oh, my gosh.
Right in the shadow of the Sandias, and it was wonderful. If we didn't have grandkids in Florida, that's where we would be right now.
Yeah. So that's what you do to Florida. Yeah.
Oh. Bobby Jean and Jim have a tent downtown Albuquerque.
That's a great city.
Yeah, I spent some time there as a youth. I don't know what I did wrong, but I spent some time there as a youth. So, Mr. Shepherd, Let's talk about you. Now, you were a songwriter as well at one time. Is that true?
Yeah, I've had many incarnations. This is my sixth reinvention. I thought I wanted to be a railroad engineer when I was really young. Then I was a rock drummer for a while. Got that out of my system. Broadcaster, corporate guy for a long time.
Yeah, too.
I did some academia. And then, I came back. We moved back to Florida 3 years ago, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So my shrink said, why don't you write nonfiction? Why don't you try writing fiction? It might be fun. And that's what happened. The rest is history.
We have somewhat the similar paths. I was in a lot of years in the corporate field. I was a singer-songwriter and had a band called Sundown in the Northwest for a lot of years. Of course, writer and talk show host and GM and VP of an international automobile parts company. And I worked for my dad for a lot of years. I was in the military for 10 years, helicopter pilot, infantryman.
Rotary. That's really hard stuff. I mean,
it was an interesting experience. 10 and a half months at Fort Rucker, Alabama.
So you know what the collective and the cyclic are then?
Oh, absolutely. I'm working with both.
That's the one thing I could never figure out. I was really great as a pilot, just about any kind of airplane, but I never got the rotaries figured out.
Well, you know, the important thing is collective, cyclic, and RPM.
Yeah, right. Yep. Hover power is takeoff power.
Hover power, takeoff power. That's right. That's
we're talking all this. It's like author's lingo, Bobby Jean. It's just we're talking about.
Now I understand why we have at least one plane scene and one helicopter scene, at least one in this book that we're going to talk about tonight, Chasing the Captain.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was that's where I got stuck actually in the second act, Chasing the Captain. You know, Jessica has this huge fan base in the UK, and they were telling us that they wanted part of the story to be there. So I actually sent her over there and partnered up with somebody from the Met. And I got to this point in the second act where she almost had her bad guy. He was getting away in a helicopter at the top of this building, and she, you know, the usual Jessica emotional making bad decisions thing. She went and grabbed one of the skids as it was taken off and ended up putting a couple of bullets into the turbines. And the thing was going down over what is over your shoulder in your picture right now, Bobby Jean, that very
right
thing,
here.
The London Eye, don't call it a Ferris wheel. And one of the spoilers is that she had to let go and she shot out the top of one of those pods and landed, you know, butt first in a bunch of broken glass. So that was the highlight. And when I wrote that, I figured I can't do anything better than this. So I was stuck.
But you managed.
Yeah, you know, you just keep, my friend Doug Lyle says, you just keep writing. You know, you keep writing. But and if you can't write forward, write backwards. And eventually it comes to you. And I was very satisfied with how the story finally progressed. It was great fun. And it's been fun to see. It takes at least two books, I think, before people start to notice. And the biggest complaint I have right now is that I don't have book three done yet. So I got to finish that one up.
You know, let's talk about Jessica Ramirez because she's quite the character. But more so interesting is that your ability, because we've had several writers on here that were male and were writing in the female genre first person, but never one. Of Jessica's ilk, I will say opinionated, Latina, which automatically says opinionated. She's just, I mean, she's a rough and tumble chick. And she does not take no for an answer. And she doesn't take crap off of anybody.
No, she's sassy.
And you did it almost seamlessly.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for that. I mean, she's based on a real person. She's based on a very good friend of mine that I've known for many years. A 25-year law enforcement veteran named Tracy Ruiz, and we've been great friends. So it's almost like, the actor studio, the method acting thing. My research is I need to spend time, lots of time, with people who I'm going to populate my books with. So I really enjoyed that dimension of it. Not only writing with her before her retirement when she was on the road, but getting to know her family. And I spent a summer in South America when I was a rock drummer touring Chile. So we did family stays there. And I made very close friends with our host family in Santiago, and we're still brothers and sisters to this day. So I almost feel credible in that space to be able to write about that.
You did. You were very credible in it. And you have several female characters that you write. Bobby and I talked about this today, and I just have to ask, because we were both wondering how the hell this happened. How did Michael get out of the car explosion?
Yeah, that's the one question and I guess that's spoiler alert, but
we're going, wait a minute. This is the only spoiler alert we're gonna do.
I went back, I read pages before it, I read pages after it. I actually read this book twice, pretty much, in order to get all the people sorted, because I often read late at night, which is not a good thing when you have complicated. We're in Washington, D.C., we're in London, we've got two really strong females working together and on both sides of the ocean, and I was getting them confused.
Yeah,
and
it's easy to do.
I actually had to kind of and I'm going to actually keep a list of the names of everybody and what side are they on.
Well, you know, I always think about the big screen when I try and write stuff. So I'm thinking about how that action, you know, if you look at the Marvel metaverse, it's very hard to keep all those people straight, especially when they're doing one of those buddy things where there's six or seven of them fighting at the same time.
Yeah.
And that was a problem in Vega, the first book, is that I really had too many people, and it was hard to keep them straight. But in this one, I tried to pare it down a little bit, but I really wanted to have... a lot of these characters kind of emerged. The guy who runs MI6, Mo Gerhardt, who's based on a guy that I know, another friend, who happens to live his life in an electric chair, as he calls it. He's a wheelchair-bound guy. And I gave him one scene. I asked him if I could use him in one scene in the cameo. And he said, yeah, but he was so powerful in that scene that he took over. So he basically ended up running MI6 for the second half.
He's a great character, and he's a great character.
Yeah, he's a good character,
Yeah, and the electric chair kind of shows that we have chairs quite a bit in this book. I mean, we have an opening scene in a chair. We have Jessica in chairs.
The real electric chair.
Once we have the wheelchair, we have chairs kind of show up, and there's always something very engaging that's happening when there's a chair.
Well, when I started this out, a piece of advice that Dan Brown gave me was, you know, you open up the chapter, you get your character in trouble, and you leave him in a cliffhanger that you don't know how to solve. You try and put him in that corner, and then that gives you the energy to go to the next chapter to write it. But it also hopefully gets people like you, Bobby Jean, to stay up late and figure out what's coming on next.
Well, Jim, you realize that there's like four cliffhangers in the very beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
And then as you're reading, you're like, what about that one? What about that cliff? What about that guy in the very first scene who sends a text? When are we going to know? How is he going to hook all those up?
And that was the fun part, is trying to figure out how to put all those puzzle pieces together, because you get a notion. I'm sure you've heard this from other writers. You get a notion which makes a really good scene, and then you say, wait a minute, I have to set that up someplace. So you got to go back in the book.
So did you have those all kind of in the beginning, or as you were writing, did you get the idea, this is something I need to go back and do a teaser for this? How did that flow for you?
Well, Captain actually started out as a short story. I wrote it was kind of a Twilight Zone thing of Jessica witnessing the execution, which is at the opening of the story. Only there's two points of view. We see her watching it, and which is what ended up being in the Captain. But we also went into the head of the guy sitting in the chair. And I wrote it a lot like, I don't know if you guys remember the great movie that we all were shown in elementary school, Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. It's a story about, it ended up on Twilight Zone. It's a story about a guy that...
They're
hanging a guy for treason or something, and the rope broke, and he goes running back to his, you know, cottage and sees his wife, and then at the last minute he chokes, and what happened is that he was imagining all that between the time they kicked the board out and the time the rope snapped his neck. So in the short story, the guy in the electric chair basically relived it was as if he figured out all the bad stuff, and he went to the house to, he found his wife with another man and all this stuff, and ended up killing them both. And then he feels at peace, and he's finally resting at last. And then there you hear the thunderclap, and it's the electricity coming on that kills him.
Right.
So,
right.
But that was the beginning. And what happens with a lot of these things is that people want to know what happens next. And my wife, who's my, you know, kind of my muse in this, she says, you got to do something more with this. So that's how the story began.
Right.
Okay.
That's well, what Coach Jessica in England.
It's the second story, second book in what's obviously going to be a series. So we often interview authors that we're reading something that's way, way down. And, you know, it's the newest one, but there were eight that went in front of it. So it's interesting to me as a reader that truly you can pick this up, any great series, you can pick it up and you can enjoy it without having to have read the first one, Chasing Vega. But I did find your references to things that happened in Chasing Vega. That's where I got a little muddled at times. And then I thought, well, that's purposeful because he wants me to go read Chasing Vega. So he's not going to tell me everything.
That was a marketing ploy, Bobby G.
Yeah.
Shameless self-marketing, eh, Jerry?
Well, that's how we find stuff, right? I mean,
exactly.
I came into Raymond Chandler in The Big Sleep, and I wanted to figure out what was before and what was after. Doesn't matter where you enter.
I walked into Ian Fleming in Her Majesty's Secret Service.
And that's one of the best ones. I really like that book.
Everything. All 13 original Fleming books after that. Just one right after another. We have to take a real quick break, Terry. Don't go away. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block, and we'll be right back after this word from LA Talk Radio. If you have never listened to LA Talk Radio, then you need to treat yourself to one of the best online live radio stations around. If you have listened to talk radio and, let's be honest, found yourself saying, I can do that better, well then, LA Talk Radio wants you. See, we have 50-minute slots available all day, Saturdays and Sundays included, and we are looking to fill those slots with high-quality broadcasts from talk hosts that are in the know. If you think you have what it takes, go to www.latalkradio.com and click the link that says Become a Host. Then just follow the simple instructions. Before you know it, you'll be joining the legion of radio folks that got their start right here at LA Talk Radio. That's www.latalkradio.com. You have something to hear at LA Talk Radio. And we are back with our guest, Terry Shepherd. And if you want to call and talk to Terry, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815, and the number again, 323-203-0815. You mentioned something, Terry, about having to put everything together and making sure that, you know, all the split pieces were joined at the end. I did one book like that, and I'll never do it again, but it's called Eastern Men.
Yeah.
And it's like these nefarious bad guys are looking for this writer, and the guy that he maligned, Mike McManus in Brooklyn in Ward 5. He's looking for this writer. There's two bad guys named, what is their name, Bobby Jean? You know. Lenny and Whitey.
Lenny, yeah.
And they're looking for this guy. And the Hunter and Jeff Stryker have got this guy. And they all wind up in Tombstone. And I figured, how the hell am I going to get them all in Tombstone at the same time? I managed, don't ask me how.
That's fun, though. It is fun.
But, man, does it work.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what happened. We get everybody over in London. And you do have four very strong women. And we talked about Jessica for just a moment. But she has a really terrific partner. And then there are two women in London. There's
Zoe and Lee, right? Yes. Yeah. And I love you guys. You actually read the book.
And these are really super women. They're like superheroes. Even if they were men, they would be superheroes. They have no fear. They have attitude. Their dialogue, what they say, even to their male counterparts. You make this book as a thriller. Terry, it's very relevant
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was my goal.
Characters are very relevant. The situation, kind of what's happening with electronics and cars that can drive themselves and hacking and all the tech stuff, it's today. It's very contemporary writing about what the world is today. And these four women are so unusual in that I don't know. Jim, have we ever read anything else with four women like these women?
I'll tell you what we haven't read, Bobby. And one thing I was extremely impressed with is your switching from back and forth to male to female dialogue.
Yes.
You actually caught the female dialogue the way females talk. And they're so different than males. I mean, men, you know, we're guttural. We, you know, talk
with
our
talk?
Mostly. Well, yeah, we grunt a lot, and we, you know, talk with our butt mostly. But women have a way of pushing information out there that is insistent that you listen. And you caught that in these female characters, and I really like that. I especially like Jessica was good, but I especially like Lee from South Africa. That chick had it all together. I mean, she was nobody to mess with. I wouldn't even mess with her. I mean, not with a loaded.
When I was developing Lee, that she, my friend Louise Dawn, who is from South Africa, I asked her. I said, I want a woman of color, and that would somehow be relevant in London. Why would she be there? And so she came up with the notion. She says, make her dad a diplomat, a Caucasian, and make her mom a Zulu that fell in love when he was in South Africa. And growing up in South Africa these days is very dangerous. I mean, it's a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So Lee, you know, came to London for Lee as like a walk in the park. She is fearless, but she's also smart. You know, she doesn't really take a whole lot of chances. I think the biggest chance she took was her falling in love with Alexandra.
Yeah.
But how could you not? I mean, that was
how
the problem in Vega.
Yeah.
My early drafts of Vega, Allie was much more interesting than Jess.
So yeah.
I had to heat up the competition between the two of them. I love it when they're, you know, Allie's always saying, I got to pull your chestnuts out of the fire. And Jessica says, I got this covered. Why are you here? You know, leave me alone.
I was curious about how characters maybe developed between the first book and this one. Let's just take Jessica. How does this Jessica differ from the Tia?
She, in Vega, initially, it was her against the cops, her against the police force. Because just like Tracy's real life experience, it's the last of the patriarchy, the last of the misogynist cultures, as some of these cop shops were, some still are. And that was Tracy's experience. And part of it was she told me all these stories and none of them had happy endings. So I finally said, well, let me write one where I can at least give you a happy ending to your story. And there's a sequence in Vega that is from real life, from Tracy's real life, where she gets a really bad situation going and she gets a chance to watch some revenge happen. And that, I think, was very satisfying for a lot of the readers. But what she was, it was her versus the cops at the beginning of Vega. And then along comes Vega and this captain guy over in Russia who kill her father. They try to get her out of the game because they know she's connected to family. So they want to blow up the entire family, but because it's part of the cliffhanger in Vega is this ticking time bomb of them getting out of the house. And the dad doesn't. And he doesn't because he's gone to church to try and talk to his padre about his relationship with Jessica and how he can make it better. So he's figured it out at last, and he comes home to make the phone call to her, and that's when the place blows up. So then it shifts to revenge, right? So in Vega, it's a revenge story, and what Jessica learns there is when you get revenge, there is no revenge. Mm-hmm. You don't feel fulfilled in that situation. Mm-hmm. So in Captain, I think part of her evolution there is trying to begin to come to terms with her feelings for Michael Wright, the FBI guy who was her boyfriend. Because in Vega, she's just not having any.
So he is, and I assumed he had to be in Vega because it felt like they already knew each other.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, there was some kind of a relationship.
Okay. He asks her to marry him at the end of Vega.
Yeah, and that's right. He's
one of
in
the things
hospital,
that drove my readers nuts was I didn't give him an answer. I left him hanging. The last two words in Chasing Vega are Jessica smiled.
Well, yeah. And I'm not sure we really know with the end of this book either.
Yeah.
Well, he's still at it in this book, so.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right about the. I grew up in a household with some very amazing women, and it inspired me to want to, as a corporate guy, you know, every chance I got to try and break the glass ceiling, to try and give energetic, creative women, if not the opportunities that I could give them, at least the energy to believe that they could do stuff. And that transferred as well to, you know, the disaffected and minorities. I mean, I've always been a huge proponent of equality. Growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in our household, I didn't even realize the extent to which there was racism until I got into junior high, because our family was always having people of all colors and all shapes and sizes. And they'd bring opposing political viewpoints together for dinner and let them fight. And what is different now than it was then is in those days, people could fight with class. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot about how you could say you're wrong without you're bad, right?
Right, and still have a relationship and a friendship.
Yeah,
and, you know,
and so the women that were there, I mean, it's just, I assumed that, you know, when the women that I was surrounded with had that, you know, they were wrestling with challenges with power and selfhood and all that kind of stuff, but they were wrestling with it. They were fighting to try and figure it out. And so that's when I started writing, I really wanted to try and channel that into the female characters and all my betas. You know, my audience is primarily women, so all my betas were people that looked and lived like the characters that I had. And that was incredibly helpful because they told me when I got it wrong, and they did it in a very loving and supportive way because they knew that if I got it right, it was going to help them out as well.
Sure. But gentlemen listening, this is not a chick book. You can read this book... And
this is actually a pretty bloody book.
Engaged, right?
I wanted it so that women could have the same adventures as men, you know? I mean, Jessica could be James Bond.
If she was a real actress,
I'd be lobbying for her to get the role.
Did I read that you have a Twitter? Jessica has her own Twitter account. Does she have her?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. See, that's Seth Godin told me that you start a year before your book to promote it. And I only had 6 months. So the first thing I did was create Jess Ramirez. And she had some luck early on. She had one post that she put up about, and maybe you've seen it because it's went very viral. It's the video of the kid on Halloween coming up and finding an empty a candy bowl at a house. Uh-huh. And it's taken from the camera. And what he does, he says, "Look, Mom, there's no candy here. The next people aren't going to have any. Let's give them some of mine." That ended up with 23.4 million views.
Oh, my gosh.
And it still comes up. I still see it in there. But that, you know, she tweeted to cop shops. She found women cops and made friends with them. I'm very clear that she's fictional, but she's had two marriage proposals from them. One of them, you know, I told the guy, I said, "Look, I'm Jessica. She's not real." And he goes, That's okay. Can I have her mailing address? Email
there
address.
There you go. Yeah, can I write her a letter? Reading this book, I was picturing Jessica Ramirez, and I was thinking, okay, now if Terry should get lucky by some happenstance that he gets a screenwriter wants to do a movie in this. Who would you put?
Who would you cast?
I'll tell you who. Marissa Ramirez. She plays Baez on Blue Bloods.
Yes. That's a great idea.
She's fabulous.
Perfect.
That's a great idea. And I do have a I do have a plan for that, by the way, because I realized, you know, I have some friends at Paramount and I know some people at Netflix, and they said, "Look, in the current political environment, they're not going to take a story about a Latina woman from a white guy. Nobody's going to produce that." So what I've discovered is that the stars run the system, right? So what I need to do is I need to get a star like her who will say, "Look, I love this story. Produce it." My friend R. Franklin James got that deal. So somebody got a hold of her book series. It's now a Lifetime series. So what I did was I translated Vega into Spanish.
I saw that.
And the way that I did it was the person that I hired to do it, I said, "Look, just follow the general plot lines, but really make this immersive for Latino readers. So you can change whatever you want, do more with the family stuff than I did. Whatever you think will really connect with them, do that. And then that person knew a professor and down in Texas who did Spanish lit in college. So we sent him a box of books and he assigned it to his class. And I said, what I would like them to do at the end of the semester, spring of this year, is to cast the movie for me.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So I'll have 110, you know, lists. And what I'll do is I'll figure out if there is, you know, some traction for anybody. I'm going to take it to that person's handler and say, look, I think that you got to buy this property because her fans want her to be this person.
There you go.
Who knows? I mean, these days you got to do crazy stuff like that to make it work.
You've just shared gold nuggets for any of our listeners who are writers or wanting to be writers or who are trying to figure out how to take what they've, you know. I don't know that, Jim, that we've had anybody really talk about these kinds of things before we had to go to a break.
But let me take a real quick break here and we'll be right back. Don't go away, Jerry. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. And if you are someone who thinks that they've got what it takes to be on the radio, www.latalkradio.com. Follow the link that says be a host. And right now, we're going to have a brief, short message from Tuscany Bay Books. I was sitting in my private office looking out my private window, dropping private eye drops in my private eye. When a tall blonde walked by, and now you asked me how I know she was tall, my office is on the second floor. And then there was a knock on the door, so I jumped out of my chair, I tripped over the couch, I unlatched the latch, and there stand a beautiful blonde holding a manuscript, and I said, hi. She said, hi. What can I do for you? I said, well, she said, I have a manuscript, and I want my book published. And I said, well, you've come to the right place. This is Tuscany Bay Books, and that's exactly what we do. Why don't you come in? And we'll have a drink on it, but all I have is a bottle of ink. So we drank that and stood around feeling mighty blue. But you don't have to feel mighty blue, because at Tuscany Bay, we'll not only format your book, we'll proofread it, we'll edit it, we'll get it printed, and we'll bitch you a cover that will make your head spin and make you so proud of the work that you've done. Tuscany Bay Books, you can't go wrong, and you can find us on the web at www.tuscanybaybooks.com. And if you see a blonde walk by, holding a manuscript and a bottle of blue ink, just say hi. And we are back with our guest, Terry Shepherd.
That's great.
And of course,
sorry. I love this. This is so worse.
You know, we got to make them fun.
Yeah, well, I did my preparation. I've listened before, but I've heard that spot. But it's just great.
Anyway, if you want to call and talk to Terry, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. You know, I'm listening to you talk, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's so much in common that we have between, you know, our writing, my writing, and your writing, and where our books have gone. You just mentioned that, you know, you had a college giving your books out, you know, for their literature course. It was in Jonah Blue. My one that I've dreamt the entire story was in three history classes in three colleges in Southern California.
That's terrific. See, that's what we got to do. You have to find ways to purpose your art beyond the conventional. That's a real secret.
And I sent that book, and I sent Jefferson's Chance to Suzanne DePass. And I got an email back from the secretary saying, yes, we got your book. It's on her desk. But, you know, it's on her desk. It's on her desk. It's on her desk. You know, it's liable to be there until I'm 90, but that's okay. But it's on her desk. let's get into a little bit of your process, Terry. When you're coming up with a story, where is it coming from? Is it, do you sit down and you want to do a storyline and you just kind of like pull it out of your head, or do you think about it long and hard, or do you dream it, or how do you come up with your storylines?
Well, I try and think of a central premise, you know, something that I can kind of peel the onion to figure out what's in the center. And the part of the way that I do it is I'll start three or four Jessica stories and I'll get 10 or 15,000 words into it, and I'll decide whether or not I want to roll with it. in some cases, I have three different plot lines that I'm looking at for Jess 3.0. One of them I'm up to 60,000 words in, and I'm not sure that I want to use it. You know, I'm looking at it, and it's not going the way I want. Mm-hmm. Another one is actually a potential collab. It probably won't happen this year, but I have another author friend who has her own detective who in her latest book is going on maternity leave in her place. So Jessica's, we've done some work on that, and I've got about 25,000 words in that one of Jessica and Michael both moving to suburban Boston to see if they can make it together.
Oh, cool.
He takes a job with the FBI office in Boston. She takes this gal's job in Bridgeton is the name of the city, the fictional city. And they live together to see if it'll work out. But there's things, you know, that gets in their way. And it's fun because Grace McKenna, this is Kate Anslinger's paranormal mm-hmm. detective. Kate's a terrific writer, really a terrific writer. And I love Grace. So there's some scenes where Jess and Grace are together, and Grace is the alley type character in this one. So, and they're fun because they both are very, you know, strong people. They have gifts, and Jess figures out Grace's gift that nobody else knows except her boyfriend. And so that's another bond that brings them together. But, you know, the process is you start out with that, you kind of see where it goes, see if you like it. And if it is, you keep writing. And if it isn't, you do something else. I mean, I was at breakfast on my birthday with my wife. And the guy sitting next to us struck up a conversation. Turned out he was in Jacksonville for a month. And what he does, because he works his own gig, he can live anywhere. So he made a list of all the places he wanted to see in the U.S. And he's moving to each place for a month and living in an Airbnb.
Yeah.
So that got me to thinking, what if I did a male protagonist, retired cop, and his wife gets killed and he wants to find out about her. So he goes to every city she's ever lived in and lives there in an Airbnb for a while. It starts like that. And then you mm-hmm. see whether or not you like the idea. And if you do, you run with it. If you don't, you'll drop it. And mm-hmm. you never throw anything away though, right?
No.
You got to save it all because you may need it later.
You know, I Richard Polinelli and I wrote a book together. It's called The Last Lonely Trail. And writing with someone else in tandem is something that I never had done before, and I don't know that I ever really want to do it again. Richard was easy to do because he'd write three chapters and send them to me, and then you read those three, and then you keep the movement of the story going, and you write your three, and then you send him all six back.
Yeah.
So that's how we went back and forth on The Last Lonely Trail, but. Coming up with the characters, his was a fictional character, mine was a real character. And they do a 180 to each other in the middle of the book. His character, David Crockett Hall, is a U.S. Marshal that his family's been massacred and he's going after him with a vengeance. Now, we know about vengeance. My character is J.B. Armstrong, who was an actual Texas Ranger. And he's the one that caught John Wesley Hardin.
Okay. Yeah.
And he's not so fast to shoot someone as because that's what he's been taught in the Texas, you know, if you don't have to kill him, don't kill him, you know. Bring him home to roost. Well, in the middle of the book, their kind of scenarios change and Hall is starting to keep JB now from shooting everybody he sees, and you know, JB's telling Hall, well, you know, damn it, just shoot his ass.
That's a Mel Gibson character.
Yeah. Well, we had a lot of that in Chasing the Captain.
Yeah.
That's a really good reviews. But it's something that I don't know that I would ever want to do again. Have you ever collaborated on a book with another writer?
Well, you have to have chemistry. You know, your whole team has to have, right. You have to have that chemistry. That's first. This is what I like about our conversation because you guys have done your homework on me. We have a lot in common. So it's very easy for us to slide into a bunch of different places. And
sure.
the ego goes away and it's just the joy, right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
That's part of what you have to give up when you're in a collab is you have to decide what you're going to let go and what you're going to fight for in the story.
Right.
And if you have the right partner, you don't worry about it. You know, you
right.
just, the end goal is to get the thing done together. And the short story collabs that I've done, we always try and put the protagonist into a corner that the other guy can't get him out of. You know, that's the thing. We writers like to do that.
Right.
And that's the fun part.
Right.
But it takes time sometimes because when you do this for a living, you get really good at putting him into these corners. And
yeah.
It's hard. You can't just say, And then all of a sudden, doors open, guns. It's not plausible. It won't work for me.
It's funny you should say that, because in this particular book, Last Colonial Trail, there's a scene where they run into these two bad guys that Hall has been chasing, and they have a shootout on the steps of this saloon. And they're both on their horses, and these two guys are in chairs. And before when the shootout's over with, Hall is on the ground. His horse is fine. Armstrong's on the ground. His horse is shot dead, and he's pissed. So they're walking down the street after putting an end to these two guys, and Armstrong turns to Hall, and he goes, "I really like that horse." And Hall says, "Look, I'll get you another horse. There's other horses." He goes, "Yeah, but I really like this one."
See, that's the other thing I think, Bobby Jean, that we need to have in a good book is quotable lines.
Yes.
Exactly.
There weren't enough of them, I thought, in Vega. So I tried to put more of those that you would, Caddyshack lines, you know, into the chapter.
Exactly. When you can camp it up just a little bit and have fun with it. I'm going to ask you the question, but a question, dialogue. When you write your dialogue, do you read it back to yourself out loud?
That's my last edit. I'm also a book narrator. I stumbled into that one. And because of my broadcast background, I knew enough to get started. And I always try and find the best people in the world that are in the space and ask their advice. And that's what I did when I started writing. The people at the time I thought were the best. I wrote to four of them and said, you know, I'm going to be 65. I'm reinventing myself again. I'm not a stalker.
You're a youngster.
I don't want anything from you. I just, but if you were starting right now, what's one piece of advice you'd give me? And every one of them said, I'll do more than that. You know, Patterson said, send me a chapter, you know, and he gave me an outline to see, this is how outlines work and stuff. And, So that was what I in dialogue for me. I love writing dialogue because that's total immersion. You know,
exactly.
When you're doing it right, Bobby Jean, you know what great dialogue is. It feels like you're actually there, like you're the fly on the wall.
Yeah.
And when characters switch, the whole brain switches. It's like you're Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost, right? When people were jumping into her body. Yeah. Maybe what you do with your hair.
Well, you know? And you want to read it. You want to, I would say to my husband, oh my God, listen to this. And then I would, you know, read it. And he didn't really know where it was coming from, because the last time I read him something was maybe, you know, 50 pages ago. But that's, I think, what's so compelling with great dialogue and descriptions of action.
You can move the story forward so fast with good dialogue. Yeah. That's really true. And when you actually have to read it aloud, I mean that whole thing that you find first place, you find all the little stuff that you and your editor missed because when you're reading it, it just jumps out at you. But the other thing is that you really get a slap in the face about authenticity, because if it doesn't sound realistic, you won't hear it in your narration.
Yeah, because real dialogue staccato. It's not smooth.
And people have insights, right? I mean, that's one of the things I love about both Jess and Lee in this story is they're, you know, as they're talking to each other, something will click in their brain.
Exactly.
And you have to show that in the dialogue. And it's one thing to do it, you know, just to write it down. But when you actually are reading it back as a narrator and you have to stop and have that insight come through you, that's when you know whether you've done it right or wrong.
It's like Bobby Jean said, action sequences. And action sequences... I like writing because I like putting the characters in situations where it's either die or move.
And that's where dialogue is really cool, Jim, because that's how I love doing action sequences with dialogue. The scene at the high rise, you know, where Allie and Lee break in to rescue Jessica. That's all dialogue. And they're all like fighting. I mean, Lee and Allie are flirting with each other with bullets flying around them. And Jessica saying, guys, come on, can you focus here, please?
Well, there's that sort of small but important scene where they're getting into a vehicle and, we have the gentleman you talked about earlier that I think he's the one that's normally in a wheelchair. Anyway, he starts to get violently ill and they're trying to, they know he's been poisoned.
Yes.
And they have to think so fast, you know, who did what? And then she realizes right away it's a poison on the handle. And but they're thinking, we get to see how their brains are going because they're verbalizing what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is just a small scene. It's not even a spoiler alert because you don't know, listeners, where and when that's going to happen. But, you know, it's that kind of little actions that give this book so much depth of interest. You know, that didn't necessarily have to happen, but you put it in there.
You put it in there, yeah.
That's what makes it fun. You know, they put those little pieces in there that you try and think about, how do I get them from point A to point B?
Yeah.
How do I get Allie over to London? You know, how do we do that?
They're nuggets, Terry. They're nuggets. Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Hang on just a second. We're going to have one final word from a sponsor, and then we'll be right back with you. This is LA Talk Radio, and we'll be right back to the Writer's Block after this brief word from Creative Edge Publicity. Okay, you've written a book. How are you going to get your name out there? Well, the folks at Creative Edge Publicity will. That's their job. They aren't going to sell your book. They don't want to sell your book, but they will take your brand from the ground up so you are known in your genre and within the writer's community. They'll do this by using relationships with contacts they've made in TV, in radio, podcast, and publishing to get your name and your brand recognized. So why are you waiting? Contact Creative Edge Publicity at www.creative-edge.services or email Mickey Mickelson at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com. Creative Edge, it's your work and it's your brand. Why would you trust it to anyone else? Creative Edge Publicity. Well, thank you, Bobby Jean. I'm glad we heard your chair moving around. And
I had to make a point. I brought my battery over when I moved my laptop, and I was almost out of power.
Oh.
And I just didn't realize.
Any question, Terry?
Yeah, I mean, that's when you're talking about Creative Edge, and a good publicist is really essential to your team.
Oh, gosh, isn't that the truth?
It's Mickey does a good job for me.
For somebody fairly new in the biz, I mean, I think I was his number second or third client. And he's been a good friend over the years. And now Tuscany Bay has a relationship with Mickey. And, you know, all the new writers that we have come on board with Tuscany Bay, if they don't have a publicist, they do now.
Yeah, that's great. I love how you set up your business. That's so cool. You make it easy. It's almost like a Chinese menu. Whatever you need, that you can, you can do it for them.
You can choose.
Yeah, I think that's great.
It's like we just had two new books break, and we've got two more breaking in February 1st, and then one in February 15th and one in March 15th. So, and then we just got another one, plus we got three more Declan Finn books at the end of the year. So, we're busy guys right now.
Yeah.
Plus, I have to read a book a week for this show.
How do you find time to write?
I early in the morning.
So, do you have a word count goal, or how do you get it done?
No, I write as I have time anymore. I mean, I used to sit down and just pound them, but I can't do that anymore. I'm about three quarters of the way through a new book, and I just can't finish it. Anyway. Have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, and in the 1.5 minute we have left, how did you get out of it? Go.
I did have it. I had that problem in the second act in Chasing the Captain, and I tried everything to get out of it. And ultimately, the person that did get me out of it was my friend Carrie Schaefer, who's also an author herself. And I said, I've tried everything and I'm really stuck. What do we do? And so she just took me down several pathways until we found the right one. She kept throwing them at me. Try this scenario, try that scenario. And that's how we did it. You need to have a good team supporting you.
Cool. What's next for Terry Shepherd?
Well, my Students in Time sci-fi book for fourth graders is out now. It's a textbook to help get people excited about learning history in the fourth grade curriculum. And, of course, Juliet and the Mystery Bug, my COVID book for kids of Dr. Seuss language, is just blowing up. I've done zero promotion for it, but it's getting in more and more doctor's offices, and I'm hoping to put it in front of Pfizer and hope they'll buy 250,000 copies from me.
Wow, that's exciting.
That would be nice, huh? What's on your bedside table?
What's that?
What's on your bedside table?
Right now, I'm reading a biography of Alfred Hitchcock.
Okay.
Oh,
actually, I think I read that not too long ago.
Yeah, he's the opposite of me in so many ways. I mean, that guy.
He's the opposite of everybody. He was like totally a crumb dudgeon.
Yeah, but I want to learn how to write in that dark corner that he does a little bit better.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, Terry, we thank you for joining us. I know it's getting late there in Florida. Of course, anytime you're in Florida, it's getting late. But late of Florida. How's that?
Right. 4 o'clock is dinner hour here. Thank you, guys. It's been great. Bobby Jean, it's so nice to meet you, too.
Nice
thank you for reading
meet
my book.
You. Absolutely. Yeah. I look forward to book three.
Love to have you back. It's going to be probably towards the end of the year, but make sure you contact the bookie or have Mickey do it and make sure he gets you listed for come back and see us again when excellent. This book is done.
And good luck with the network. This just sounds like a great enterprise you guys are spinning off.
We Bobby and I have been doing this show now for almost 7 years. Mm-hmm. And it's been a growing experience and continues to grow. I mean, right now we're up over 600,000 listeners. So we're big. We're not a little schlock show.
Well, it's obviously the host because you put up with guests like me, right?
It's all about the guests.
Anyway, thank you so much, Terry, for joining us. And next week we have Mark Leslie is back with us. That's the man I call Anton LaVey. I mean, he looks just like Anton LaVey. For those of you who don't know who Anton LaVey is, writer of the Satanic Bible. But Mark Leslie is not him. So anyway, he's back with us next week. And of course, Bobby Jean, always a pleasure. And you'll be back with us next week. Yes. And I'm sure she'll be back with us next week. And along with, I believe, Mr. Henry Park is with us.
Oh, because we're already February next week.
It's February. I think it's the third. Okay. Again, Terry, thank you so much. Hang on for a minute or two if you want to after the show. And for Bobby Jean Bell, and of course Jim Bell and Sam Hassan, our owner and our engineer, Mr. Richard Polinelli, my business partner, good friend and co-host, and Russ Avison, who could not be here with us tonight, and of course, the bookie, without whom none of this would be possible. We are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.